Hey everyone, I'm Julie Gunlock, host of the Bespoke Parenting Hour. For those new to this program, this podcast is focused on how parents should custom tailor their parenting style to fit what's best for their families, themselves, and most importantly, their kids. Parents have been really demonized in our culture over the past several years. We all remember being called domestic terrorists for complaining at our local school board meetings. We remember being called granny killers and teacher haters for not wanting to put masks on our kids. And of course, we remember being called radical for simply wanting schools to open in person. And that was after teachers were given access to the vaccine. It was rough a couple years ago during COVID, and it doesn't seem like anything's changed recently. Now, parents are being demonized for not automatically affirming their child's so-called gender preferences, name changes, and that's if they even know there's been a name change, and request for mutilating surgeries and life-altering pharmaceutical interventions. And who is doing this? Sadly, some of it is coming from pediatricians. To discuss that today, I'm joined by my good friend and colleague, Hadley Manning. She is Vice President of Policy at the Independent Women's Forum, and she's also a mom of four. So she has her own dealings with pediatricians. Welcome, Hadley.
Hi. Thanks, Julie. Yeah, I've been thinking a lot about the AAP safe sleep guidelines recently because we have a new baby and we're always putting him back to sleep on his back. But we'll talk more about the guidelines. A lot of things today.
I mean, honestly, I feel like the field of pediatrics is very fraught. And I think, you know, one thing that I started working on at the Independent Women's Forum years and years ago was the sort of schizophrenic nature of medical advice, that one minute they tell you something's good, the next minute something's bad. And you know, the president of IWF, Carrie Lucas, we're good friends with. And we sort of gone through each other's pregnancies together. You know, I feel like if we compared the rules when Carrie and I were having babies as compared to now, it would be totally different.
It feels like there's a lot more rules. It's hard to follow all the rules, you know. I appreciate what you're saying. I think there's a couple of high profile kind of policy reversals that come to mind with the AAP. And I don't mean to suggest that this is necessarily evidence of anything bad or nefarious. It's just that sometimes new evidence comes to light. You know, initially they were telling people, keep your kids away from peanuts. Peanuts can, you know, people can have bad reactions to peanuts. And then several years later, they said, actually, it's better to expose them to little peanuts early.
Right. You're actually giving them an allergy.
And then there was, you know, of course, with the safe sleep thing, it was, you know, it was fine to put them down on their stomach. Stomach sleeping's good. They won't choke on their spit up or whatever. And then it's like, oh, actually, we discovered that it's much safer for babies to be put down to sleep on their back. Although I've never met a baby who likes to sleep on their back.
Human being likes to sleep on their back? Actually, right. My husband sometimes sleeps on his back and I'll turn over like in the middle of the night. And he's so weird. I'm like, turn over. You're so weird. Anyway, I want to talk about another issue though. And I want to set this up. I think it's important to sort of set this up correctly so people understand why. And frankly, why we're not being alarmists here. This is truly something to be concerned about. In December, so just a couple months ago, the American Academy of Pediatrics published an article in their journal. And it's important that I say here, when the AAP publishes something in their official journal, that's serious. That conveys to pediatricians, in this case, pediatricians. But if the American Medical Association, they also have a journal. Whenever the official journal of these huge medical associations, when they publish things, it really does convey a message of this is where the medical field, what they believe. And, you know, some of this can be seen as, okay, these are peer reviewed and there's still room for debate. But when it comes to the gender issue, not so sure there is a lot of room for debate. So let me go on. So they published an article in their journal stating, quote, withholding gender affirming care is harmful to children and amounts to state-sanctioned medical neglect and emotional abuse. The article's three authors included two doctors at Seattle Children's Hospital, and that is important because Seattle Children's Hospital operates a gender clinic for ages, hold on here, 9 to 16, okay? That means children as young can begin costly medical interventions like pediatric Lupron implants, cross hormones monitoring, and getting on the path eventually to surgeries. Patients must be 18 and older to get genital surgeries, but for what they call top surgery, and let's be clear here, radical mastectomy, the removal of breast tissue and breasts, the typical age is mid-teens. this other area, I just want to, again, I'm just trying to set this up. Why this is important also is that when Seattle Children's Gender Clinic encourages kids as young as 9 to turn themselves into lifelong medical patients that need these sort of interventions for the rest of their life, it's sort of this vertically integrated profit center that, in other words, the gender clinic is literally providing a stream of medicalized and mutilated people who will need treatments for their whole life. So this is serious. And when I read it out like that, it makes sense that a parent who might be aware of the trajectory that their child is going in might say, wait a minute, you know, let's hang on. I'm not sure this is a good idea. And here you have two doctors and another medical professional saying, no, actually that's child abuse. So this is the stuff of nightmares. There's a lot there.
Yeah.
And I can't believe my question is, so Hadley, what's going on? But I want you to respond to what I've just laid out there.
Yeah. So first of all, I want to recommend to Bespoke listeners that they also tune in to the most recent episode of IWF She Thinks podcast, because in our most recent episode, Beverly, our host, interviews a mom named Lydia Smith. That's not a real name, but it's a mother in New Mexico who's experiencing this firsthand and has had to deal with horrible accusations of abuse and the involvement of the police and the medical establishment in an extremely fraught and challenging family situation where her child's identified as transgender or gender non-binary. So please go listen to that to hear somebody's personal experience with this. I don't have personal experience with one of my children experiencing gender dysphoria, but I will tell you, Julie, where the AAP lost me. The AAP lost me, you know what I'm going to say, during COVID with the mask issue and with some of the other recommendations that the AAP was making during COVID. You know, I mentioned the other reversals about peanuts and safe sleep to say that that's going to happen when you're constantly encountering new medical knowledge, new evidence. Great. If you have to reverse your position because of the evidence, then please do so. But what I saw during COVID was a leap to take a pre-identified position on something, and then the retroactive, let's fill in the evidence that we think that we need to take this position. And I encountered this at my child's preschool. You can read about it in the Washington Post if you want to. But my son was 3 years old, and I said, can we please, you know, give kids this age the option, give families the choice about if they want to put their kids in a mask or not? And constantly what I ran into was the folks on the other side of that debate at my local preschool were pointing to who, to what? To the CDC and to the AAP and to some of these medical institutions that, you know, I'm just a mom, right? So what do I know, right? But I'm doing my best to look at what's going on in Europe and to look through the studies and to look through some of the qualifications on the studies about masking. Okay, so totally different issue. But that to me was the first big fat red flag that some of these recommendations coming from the AAP were not necessarily based on medical knowledge, not based on, you know, evidence-based medicine. And now to see what's happening in this space around children who are identifying as transgender, who are, you know, unfortunately, many of them being pushed and their parents along with them through a pipeline that can start with what they call social transition or quote unquote, you know, gender affirmation into the medicalization of that confusion. And I'm talking about drugs and procedures like puberty blockers, like cross-sex hormones, and ultimately in some pretty serious surgeries, like you mentioned, mastectomy or, you know, what they call bottom surgery, which will make me blush to talk about any further, but very serious ramifications for the futures of these kids. Not only will they be lifelong medical patients, but they may lose their ability to have children. They may lose their fertility. They may lose their ability to enjoy
pleasure. Yeah.
Right. Yes. And there's mental health ramifications on both sides of this as well. And I think this is where the breakdown, you know, ultimately, this is where you meet two sides of the sword. You meet folks in the medical community who believe strongly that without these interventions, that you're increasing the risk, the suicide risk of children who identify as transgender. And I should note here that there's a huge overlap when it comes to kids identifying as transgender and comorbidities. That's a medical term, but it means, you know, other factors that might contribute to their suicide risk or risk of self-harm. And I'm talking about other mental health issues. Autism is one, but anxiety and depression, right? And we've seen like nationally, our country is experiencing a lot more anxiety, depression, and mental distress in general. I think some of that's downstream of COVID. We could get into that another day. But you've got these very troubled young people, right? And so the question becomes, I think, if you're talking about this from a parenting perspective, is who is out there that can give me the right tools to navigate this? And unfortunately, the AAP has broken trust with parents by, you know, not just publishing this most recent paper about this is, you know, tantamount to child abuse, but previous to this, with the AAP's adoption of a stance that is in favor of what they call gender affirming care without a lot of debate over the issue. And I know doctors who have done everything in their power to get the AAP to do a systematic review of the evidence when it comes to this. We've highlighted some of their work at IWF. I think that they are heroes. I appreciate what they're trying to do to try to steer this institution back in the right direction. But finally, I'll make this last point and then I'll turn it back over to you, Julie. But I think that people should recognize, if you're in the medical community, if you're parents, if you're just watching what's going on with this issue related to transgender children, this has very real, you know, tangible effects on the lives of people. That's how I first felt with the masking thing. I was like, oh, what the AAP says is actually, it's affecting me and my child. And so what's happening in the transgender, in the debate over what to do with kids who are identifying as trans or who are experiencing gender confusion has a very real impact on people's lives. It affects the way that parents feel like they can interface with the school system, the medical system. It can be very socially isolating for families who are experiencing something like this because they don't know whom they can trust and whom they can turn to because they feel like these institutions, major medical associations, are not basing their advice on sound science. And they see our peer countries in other parts of the world reversing course on this stuff. And ultimately, Julie, it's going to have ramifications in other areas of medicine because people have lost trust in what used to be an institution that would give people guidance on you know, a long list of things that we have to make choices about as parents. I mean, the AAP was founded in 1930. It's been around for a long time. And I think a lot of people used to feel like they could trust the AAP when it came to recommendations about vaccination or other standards of care when it comes to other you know, childhood diseases, parenting questions, child safety issues, and all of that is going to be undermined because of what I see as a politically driven and ideological capture of this organization.
Well, honestly, you've made so much sense and so many great points. I'm having trouble picking what threads go on there because you made so many great points, Hadley, but it's not just the AAP, most medical organizations, from nurses to the American Medical Association, these are some of our most respected institutions. And like many institutions in the United States, they have been taken over by a radical group of people. Now, one thing, I actually did a lot of research into this years ago, and I was amazed. The American Medical Association came out with some insane policy. And I called over there and I actually talked to someone and asked what the process was for issuing these guidelines. And I was shocked to find out, because I, in my sweet, innocent, non-medical mind, I thought, oh, they must pull not all members, but there must be some sort of like group of doctors.
This is representative of what the medical.
Yeah, like maybe 20% of the association. Yeah. It turns out they do no polling. They don't care what doctors think. It is this small cabal within leadership of, I mean, it's like 10 people making these sort of decisions. And so then I talked to some doctors about this and they said, we kind of take it with a grain of salt, which made me happy. But then I thought, but who knows about the new generation of doctors coming up? Do they take it with a grain of salt? Do they take it more seriously? And so, but the bottom line is that people should know that a lot of these proclamations coming out of these major medical associations are not based on what most doctors feel. There hasn't been a significant, and also that's the other thing. Not all of these sort of policy changes are based on sound science. They do a lot of stuff. A lot of these medical associations, and at the time I was researching it because they had come out with these things about environmental issues, which were based on just such flimsy science. And so I think that's important to know. But let's get back to parents. You mentioned not knowing if they, you know, parents suddenly feel like, can I trust these people? Well, Chris Elston, otherwise known as Billboard Chris, I think earlier or in last year at some point, he released some videos, some training videos of how doctors can convince parents that this is the right path. And it was horrible. These training videos were horrible because, of course, one student was acting like the parent and one student was acting like the doctor. And there was this whole script to follow. And basically, they brought up the suicidality issue. And they brought up this sort of like, do you want a child who goes through transition or do you want a dead child? You know, and all this. And then this has also affected the psychological side of the psych industry, basically, child welfare and all of these industries related to psychology. Where can parents go, Hadley? What do they do? Because if you're aware of this situation and your child has one of those comorbidities, right? Maybe they have body dysphoria. Maybe they have anorexia. Maybe they have some anxiety and depression issues. And you're sitting there as a parent and you're like, okay, you know, should I take them to the doctor? I mean, how can you know that they're not going to introduce a whole nother level of problems for your child?
You know, I think that there are some somewhat underground networks of medical providers who want to help parents and want to help, you know, do what's best and get on the family's team rather than trying to get the family to subscribe to a certain path forward. And that's another thing that blows my mind about this is if you really look at the evidence, the best thing for a child is to have a strong relationship with their parents, you know, regardless of what the next steps are going to be. You do not want to do anything to drive a wedge between parents and children, because if they can otherwise have a strong relationship, that's going to be really good for everybody's mental health. And that's going to make the whole process a lot easier, no matter, you know, which direction parents decide to go. So I would encourage people to try to find out who the doctors, caregivers, therapists are that they can trust. It's a difficult thing to do because, unfortunately, and I think this speaks volumes about the problem, people don't want to be very public when they have a position that is not in lockstep. Right. With the AAP and with others. You know, you mentioned there's so many. I've got a list of over 30 organizations, major medical organizations, including the AMA and WPATH and a whole alphabet soup of, you know, the American Psychological Association, the American Academy of Family Physicians, these endocrine societies. So many organizations subscribe to the quote unquote gender affirming care, the affirmation model. And that's just what the cool kids are doing. That's the if you don't subscribe to that model, then you're automatically on defense. You know, why are you in favor of harming kids? Or why do you want to see more kids identifying as transgender committing suicide or harming themselves? So there's a real poisoning of the well when it comes to debate within the medical community about these issues. I'm really proud of the people like Dr. Julia Mason, I mentioned earlier, has really tried to get and has been successful in getting the AAP at least to do a systematic review. I hope that systematic review of evidence is fair and done well. Reasons to question whether or not it will be, but that's a good first step. I will say in terms of the AMA, boy, that's an organization that, you know, they come in to testify before state legislatures or Congress and they wear the white coats, and that just commands so much credibility because it seems from all perceptions that this is someone speaking on behalf of the entire medical establishment. But if you look at membership in the AMA, in the 1960s, more than 80% of practicing American physicians were members of the AMA. And by the 2010s, that number had shrunk to below 12%. I've seen polling where something like 11% of physicians say that the AMA reflects their views. So there's a lot of people in the medical community who don't subscribe to, you know, all the positions, sort of political positions that some of these major medical organizations are taking. So I'd encourage people that, you know, it's a very loud vocal minority. It's people who are extremely motivated to get on these committees that, you know, decide what the guidelines are going to be. They don't necessarily speak for all doctors or all nurses or all therapists. And there's probably more people in the medical community who are sympathetic to the, you know, to what parents are really going through and who are not trying to bully parents into a specific direction, although they can be hard to find because, as I mentioned, they've kind of been forced underground with their heterodox point of view. And that's really the tragedy here, Julie, because science is supposed to be about questioning. It's supposed to be about, you know, develop a hypothesis, test it, debate about it, have various points of view, various perspectives. Iron sharpens iron, you know, but when a whole perspective, a whole group of people feels like it's not a quote unquote safe space for them to express their dissenting opinions or even ask questions about the direction that some of this stuff is going in, then we've got a problem. That problem, you know, will affect, of course, this conversation about children who identify as transgender, but it will also affect so many other issues as well. And like I said, undermine credibility.
Hadley, you've been doing health policy for years and years for IWF and are very familiar with these health organizations. I know that there is a competitor to the American Academy of Pediatrics, and it's slipping my mind right now. I can't remember what it's called, but there is a competitor, and they often will come out and sort of give a more reasoned position or outright disagree with the AAP. Is that happening more now within the medical community? Is there more competition? Is there more choices for medical professionals?
Totally. And specifically with regard to this issue when it comes to, you know, quote unquote, gender affirming care. So the American College of Pediatricians is, I think you're thinking of, Julie. But there are a variety of organizations, like the Society for Evidence-Based Medicine is a great one. The Clinical Advisory Network on Sex and Gender is another good one. GenSpect is a good organization. And finally, I would also mention Do No Harm is an organization that was just founded in the last couple of years to speak out against some of the ideological capture of medical organizations and the medical establishment in general. So I would encourage people to follow some of those organizations, read their work. If nothing else, then to understand, you know, the dissenting perspective on some of these issues. There's, you know, no pancake so flat that it doesn't have two sides. So even if you're convinced that that this change that we're, you know, allowing children to make these very serious changes to their bodies, and we're allowing parents to shepherd their children through that pipeline of drugs and procedures that I mentioned earlier, also known as the Dutch protocol in some circles, even if you think that that's a good thing, I would really encourage you to get familiar with the other side of the argument and some of the risks and some of the downsides.
Well,
are bringing up.
And one thing that you can do, and you mentioned the latest She Thinks, where Beverly is interviewing a parent who's dealing with this. We also have our own storytelling series on detransition, and not just detransitioners, but also parents who have dealt with this issue and really, and in some cases, lost their children to this sort of infrastructure that's been set up, this sort of gender kind of craziness. So I would encourage everyone to check that out also at IWF.
Well, to bring this back to, you know, kind of where we started talking about the new paper in pediatrics that is comparing sort of any divergence from the quote unquote gender affirming care model to, you know, comparing that to child abuse or state sanctioned child neglect. Julie, you know better than anybody at IWF about some of the laws in various states that are relevant to child neglect and the ways that some of these are enforced or not enforced. It's frustrating to me as a parent. I feel like sometimes I got to run and pick up like some dry cleaning, and I can't leave a child in a car seat for 2 seconds because I'm afraid somebody's going to, take right. down my, you know, license plate number and call me in for child neglect. And so unfortunately, you know, parents are scared of things like that. Whereas there are children, unfortunately, that are really at risk of serious neglect and abuse, and particularly the youngest children, you know. So I do hope that that's something that we can get right, is the enforcement of child neglect laws and the right kinds of child neglect laws. But my goodness, we should, the last thing we should be doing to families who are struggling with a child who is, you know, in extreme mental distress over gender confusion, is layering on some yes. additional concern about you're going to have custody of your child taken yes. away from you. I mean, there have been examples, unfortunately, of custody battles between parents where they disagree about how to address the gender confusion that the child is experiencing, or there are, you know, parents who don't want to use a new name, don't want to use new pronouns, don't want to go down the quote unquote affirmation route. And they're concerned about, you know, now being accused of being abusive or neglectful of their child. That's the last thing that we should be doing. Shouldn't be driving this wedge between parents and children. We should be doing everything in our power to foster strong parent-child relationships, because that's going to be a great tool in addressing whatever the mental health issue is that's kind of upstream of some of these gender questions.
Well, Hadley, I can't thank you enough. This is really helpful. And I know we're going to keep up with this. We're going to continue to follow this issue and continue to follow, certainly when it comes to custody. This is just absolutely terrifying. And I will add that California has passed a law where it was both the assembly there and the Senate passed a law. It was vetoed, shockingly, by Governor Newsom, which I didn't think he had any shred of common sense left, but he must have seen this as a political risk. But a bill like this was introduced in Virginia, and there's another state that introduced a bill like this, but also in West Virginia, they've sort of walked back and added some parent protection. So we're seeing this sort of you know, like many things, certain states are being more conservative and more pro-parent and others aren't. Anyway, it is a developing issue that we will definitely cover. And I just wanted to also go back to the documentary series we were talking about. It's called Identity Crisis. So Google Identity Crisis, IWF, and you'll be able to find, it's really heartbreaking stories, but I think it's important to understand what some parents have gone through. Again, Hadley, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks, Julie.
The Bespoke Parenting Podcast with Julie Gunlock is a production of the Independent Women's Forum. You can send comments and questions to me at julie.gunlock@iwf.org. And please help me out by hitting the subscribe button and leaving a comment or review on Apple Podcasts, Acast, Google Play, YouTube, or iwf.org. And most importantly, hang in there, parents, and go bespoke.